Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find therein, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today, we're getting started on the N chapter of the Monster Manual, but before we talk about the monsters in this chapter, let's thank some new Patreon supporters. That's right, these are the people who've gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. And if, like today's patrons, you pledge at the $2 level or higher, you'll get access to my new show, Patron Deities, in which I do for the Deities and Demigods book kind of what I do for the Monster Manual here on Monster Man, only in a little more detail. So thank you very much to Adam Buxton and Robert Faulkner. Thank you for your support. Okay, the first monster in today's episode is the Naga. I have a little bit to say about the mythological Naga and about the different types of Naga found in the Monster Manual, but I really just want to start by drawing your attention to the part of the entry for this monster where it says that they have, and I quote, good brains. Now, assuming that this isn't some kind of recommendation for the player characters to eat Naga brains, I have to say that I find this a little disconcerting, especially considering the normal sesquipedalian verbosity of the Gygaxian idiom. Good brains. I don't even really know what it means. Does it mean that they are very intelligent? Because good brains might be the most efficient way of saying that the Monster Manual has ever used. Good brains. Anyway, so the Naga is a serpent-like deity or divine being in Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain belief. The word can actually just mean cobra, but it also refers to these snake-like beings, which either just represented as a giant snake or as a snake with many heads. And they're also said to be able to take human form, although they don't become human. A small but important distinction. And they're very important in the artwork and symbolism of these religions, not just in India, but also in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in Southeast Asia, you know, so in Cambodia and Laos. They're mostly portrayed as protective deities, and that fits with the description that we get in here of the guardian Naga, who either defends a holy site or is, as they say, a watcher over some evil, which I think is actually a very appealing way to include the Naga in your game. Now, Nagas are mostly, well, I think almost universally, portrayed as good, you know, in the writing and art of the faiths that they come from. They're specifically, you know, protectors. So that's our first Naga. That's the guardian Naga. We also have the spirit Naga, which is your bad Naga, and which gets the kind of paralyzation power, which again is in line with our sense of cobras, right? There's that belief that snakes hypnotize people by gazing in their eyes, right? Like Ka in the Jungle Book. And then you got your water Naga, which is your neutral one. So we got a good one, a bad one, and a neutral one. They're all pretty good. The Naga fundamentally is, you know, a humanized snake, so how it appears in your game kind of depends on how you think about snakes. And it's a sort of a running thread throughout a lot of religions and mythologies around the world that snakes are seen as symbols of wisdom or of something, right? So we have these protective snake deities in South and Southeast Asia. As I mentioned, of course, in the Bible, we have, you know, the serpent in the Garden of Eden, and in ancient Greek religion, snakes were also seen as symbols of divine wisdom and of immortality, I think, due to the fact that they shed their skins, so they kind of, it's a symbol of rebirth. So really, how you feel about snakes is how you're going to portray the Naga in your game, whether that's the good guardian Naga, the evil spirit Naga, or the somewhere in between water Naga. Next, we have the Neo-Otiog, and this is maybe the first time that alphabetization fails me in this episode, because really, I don't know what to say about the Neo-Otiog without reference to the Otiog, and of course, we haven't got to the Otiog yet. Is it an Otiog? Is it an Otiog? Otiog sounds cooler, but Otiog comes more naturally, so I'm going to say Otiog. Unhelpfully, for podcast purposes, although it's fine for gaming purposes, the entry for the Neo-Otiog is basically nothing but a series of references to the Otiog and how Neo-Otiogs differ from them. So you have my pledge, as creator of Monster Man, that when I get to Otyugs, I will also talk about Neo Otyugs, but we're not there yet. It shouldn't be long, though. And finally, we have the Night Hag. Now, hags in Dungeons & Dragons are kind of interesting, because normally when you or I think of a hag, like a folkloric hag, a hag as a monster, what we're really just talking about is some kind of a witch. Baba Yaga is a hag. Lots of witch stories feature this kind of crooked old crone who is, you know, casting spells on you, and I always assumed that's what we talk about when we talk about a hag. There are also maybe more obviously supernatural hags who are, like, not just witches, but kind of fairy creatures of some kind, so like, Jenny Greenteeth. And also, the Night Hag is related to the Nightmare. So this idea of a creature that comes and sits on your chest while you sleep, which is sort of a folkloric explanation of sleep paralysis. You know, there are also, while I'm kind of picking out examples of malevolent old witches who are represented as hags in folklore, there are also more ambiguous hags who are kind of forces of nature, you know, who are just sort of facts of the natural or in some cases political landscape, whose kind of favor you have to win. And I want to say that you can think about the witches in Macbeth in that respect. Again, I think they're just witches, but the idea of supernatural women handing out political authority, Monty Python jokes aside, is one that does crop up in a number of different, you know, different folklores and different legendary stories. And so a hag could be kind of the patron of a particular royal house, and I think that would be a fun story, right? When people go off looking for, you know, the woman who gives you the authority to rule, and they're thinking it's going to be the Lady of the Lake, you know, in finest samite clad, emerging nobly, looking like a pre-Raphaelite painting, and it's actually some wizened old lady who dwells in a cave and serves hell. One of the weird things about the Night Hag is that we're told the Night Hags hate goodness, but we're also told that they specifically hunt and kill people who are selfishly evil. And that is because remember way back when we talked about the larvae? The larvae are raw materials that are used by hags, by demons, by devils, and by liches to achieve certain magical effects. And larvae are damned souls, right? You know, good people who go to heaven don't form them when they die, so they're no use to the hag. So if the hag finds someone who's a real swine, they do the sitting on their chest thing and they strangle them. And then the soul becomes a larva, and then the hag can, you know, profit from the transaction, which is a pretty great motive and MO for a monster. That's a classy one. I guess the way to avoid a hag is to be kind of in the middle somewhere, which, in fairness, I think most people are. So I guess the role that the hag could play in a D&D game would be, a hag is a kind of super witch. Right? So a witch is just like, you know, an evil spellcaster of some kind. You know, witch in its classic folkloric sense. No implication about modern-day witches. So let's say you have a coven of witches. You know, a hag might kind of be their patron, almost the thing that they aspire to be. But actually, her motivation is, first, to use them to do evil, but then she's basically gonna, like, collect them all, right? So she's encouraging them all in their, you know, feats of malice. But then, at the end of the thing, she's going to choke them all out, collect the larvae, and off to hell to cash in on the profits. So that makes a hag kind of like a fun end boss for a cult-busting scenario, right? So, you know, a bunch of evil deeds are being done by some sinister robed society, and then you investigate, and in fact, if they have the kind of, you know, face-concealing hoods and stuff, the hag could still rumble you, because she's got no alignment at will. You know, you're sneaking in, the drums are pounding, the incense is in the thing, the giant, you know, whatever, brass statue of Moloch is, you know, getting nicely heated to get all the victims thrown in it, and then the hag goes, wait a minute, this guy's lawful good! You know, and then it's, hey, off with the cloaks, and, you know, the spells are flying or whatever, and the hag is just kind of going, either you get a fun hag boss fight, or the hag goes, huh, I'm out later. Yeah, so hags make fun recurring villains in that way, right? Because they might be constantly working on some kind of elaborate scheme, you know, to get themselves a bunch of souls that they can use for bargaining chips when they get back to Hades. And also, that's fun. Like, the idea that the hag is, you know, kind of takes joy in doing works of evil, but is mostly just out here farming resources for the real game, which is back in Hades. That's a fun image too, right? Like, you know, that the hag is spending night after night riding victims and draining their constitution so that she can ultimately turn them into a larva and take them back to hell. You know, actually, it's just like, what are you doing? Grinding. Oh, that's a fun idea as well. Like, what if you were in a culture where everybody knew how hag riding worked, and that it was something that only happened to evil people? So everybody would just keep shtum about the fact that they were getting sicker and sicker, and weaker and weaker. And so they wouldn't, like, tell their families, they wouldn't go to the doctor, but they might hire a bunch of shady scoundrels and murder hobos, maybe even under false pretenses, to hang around and catch the hag, although they'd better have silver weapons or +3 weapons to stab up this old lady in a frantic duvet fly-in bedroom fight. In short, I like hags. They're pretty good. They're at their worst if they're just, like, in a corridor in a dungeon, right? That's where hags are the least interesting. They're a mystery monster more than a fight monster. Because, you know, in a fight, they just fight. It's their MO and their motivations that make them really interesting. Okay, so tune in next time as we go on to talk about another sleep paralysis-related monster, the Nightmare, as well as the Nixie and the Nymph. And don't forget that episode 50 is coming up, and it's going to be a listener mailbag special. So if you've got some questions you'd like to ask me, if you've got some things you'd like to hear me talk about, requests for monsters outside the Monster Manual that you'd like me to discuss, anything like that, please send them on in to the addresses that you're just about to hear. And if you have sent me something and I haven't read it on air, that's wise, because I'm saving it for the mailbag special. Tune in next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/Monster Man, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.